and land trusts are hard to figure out and hard to understand. So I thought I'd start, before the video, I thought I'd give you just a little case history so you can kind of start to hang some tasks on what a land trust does. And there are over 1,200 land trusts in the United States. And that's for conservation of land. And then there's a new movement that we were just talking about, the idea of a land trust that allows affordable housing. And the third type of land trust you might have heard about is a farmland preservation trust. So it's a concept that allows different community values to be met. Welcome. I'm polling everybody when they come if they know anything about a land trust.
He does.
Great. And what's your background with the land trust?
It's not so much. I'm in a small community, and there's a bunch of us, a homeowners association. Mm-hmm. They're trying to lobby to get green space in our comprehensive plan that we want.
Right.
I'm looking at ways of doing that. How do you write grants to get money to do it? Because you've got the real estate developers trying to cover all this up.
Oh, exactly. That's a perfect case history that we'll kind of go into.
Okay.
So, and do you know anything about land trusts?
No, I shy away from anything like economics and.
Well, that's good, and that's actually.
It's not. It doesn't bite.
It doesn't bite.
You know.
Well, you've helped me a lot to do this week.
Yeah.
And we were just realizing a lot of us would like to hear Butch Thompson too, so we're gonna abbreviate this a little bit. We'll show just a little clip of the video and then head over, so we can all kind of get to do both. So thank you for coming, because I too would like to hear Butch Thompson. That's pretty great. If you're in Barbara's Bible study this morning.
Mm-hmm.
So she, and I think all of us struggle personally. We want to live our faith, and I know in your family unit, you have ways of living your faith, and yet we're called to live our faith collectively. And we have it within our church community, but we're called to even a greater calling that Barbara was really focusing on, a new power, a different paradigm. And global warming is a bit of a touchstone issue, but there's so many other issues too. Global warming feeds into extinction of species. Lack of, when you were a child, think back to when you were a child, the places that you could go just bum around in the woods, places that you could, you know, go on the land. All those things have become scarcer and scarcer. And there's in the education world, there's an author who's really another touchstone author. His name is Richard Lewes, and he wrote a book called Last Child in the Woods, and he coined this cute little word, nature deficit disorder. So, in mostly informal education, but people are realizing children are being kept inside. There's this whole virtual world that's so appealing. There is the idea that it's not safe to be out. You know, you have to watch your children at all times with eyes. And so it's interesting, most of the governmental agencies, the Forest Service, the National Fish and Wildlife Service, the wildlife refuges, the state parks, everybody is jumping on board with this. And our state parks created this cool little grant that was No Child Left Inside. And we all got to apply for money to, you know, basically hire school buses and get our kids outside. So it all these things kind of relate, because they're all issues that we as individuals are fairly powerless on. And I know when I'm a biologist and have an education kind of combined background, and I felt in a special obligation from my faith viewpoint to do something, to actually put into practice in my collective life something that would work toward this other paradigm. And when I moved to Wenatchee, a little tiny group called the Shalandoaks Land Trust had made this huge move. We have an incredible benevolent local funder. Harriet Bullitt started a fund called the Icicle Fund. So she is a King Broadcasting Money from Seattle. She spent her childhood in Leavenworth, and she created this incredible endowed fund to fund three things: music, drama, kind of the arts, and the environment. So we were given a grant to hire an executive director. So we went from being this little living room group of 30 people who worked hard to get $25 memberships and who were instrumental in getting the idea of what's called the loop. If you ever get to stay in Wenatchee again, we have an 11-mile paved trail loop that goes on both sides of the river, crosses both bridges. And the land trust is a little living group kind of hatched the idea. And then, of course, it was controversial. Of course, it was hard. All kinds of issues. But the Land Trust kind of takes credit for hatching the idea. And then another group called Friends of the Loop kind of got that going. And if you've ever hiked in through Spider Meadow, that was there was some part of the Spider Meadow land that was not national forest or wilderness. And so again, this little living room group, the Shalandoaks Land Trust, hatched the idea to do a big fundraising campaign that was on both sides of the mountain to permanently protect that trail that goes into Spider Meadow. So you know, our 30-member group saw the power of collective good and working for the community. And since then, I came out as a board member with that first executive director in 2000. So the growth that we have seen, and I know personally, it's the most significant, fulfilling volunteering that I do. I get more back than I give. It's collective. It's with people who all have a shared vision, who are thinking outside of the box. So, you know, from a personal level, I spend 5 to 10 hours a week as a volunteer for this organization. And it's just been very exciting to see what we are able to do collectively. So I'll show you just a couple, I'll read a couple things. This is kind of who we are. The Chelan Douglas Land Trust is a private, nonprofit organization based in Wenatchee, Washington. Founded in 1985, we're comprised of over 300 active members and volunteers, a board of directors and staff. The Chelan Douglas Land Trust envisions, and this is that book of Revelations, we envision a community that conserves and cherishes our land, our water, our way of life, now and for generations to come, through voluntary land agreements, education, partnerships, stewardship, and well-planned growth. So those are all big tasks, and our particular county has a very conservative political background. So when we first started working in the year 2000 on these big ideas, we had one county commissioner who in public stated that he did not want to follow the state constitution to do land use planning. He would only follow the federal constitution. So we know we had incredible, nothing to do with land use planning, and that was the point, because they didn't want to do land use planning. So here we had, you know, I mean, talk about David and Goliath. And yet we have taken this approach to have conversations with these commissioners. We are not adversarial. We go to the meetings, and we have developed a wonderful working relationship. And since then, that commissioner was replaced by somebody a little more moderate. But it really has been an example to me of when you think that the odds are impossible, we as a collective group have been able to really move forward. So I'll show you a couple things that we've done. This is called the Good Neighbor Handbook, and I'm going to leave it up here, some of these up here. We are an area, and I think as you, if you've been coming to Holden for a while, you probably noticed the growth. Chelan, the whole riverfront development, I think as you drive from Wenatchee to Chelan, there are all these vacation homes now lining the Columbia River. So we are kind of Seattle's backyard, people doing early retirement. Our prices are still a little lower than Seattle, so people can sell homes and buy up here. So we really have a very rapid rate of growth. So this was designed, you know, we have a target audience with people moving here. So we put together this just information, and we partnered with the PUD, we partnered with the county, and we put together this Good Neighbor Handbook that has everything from how you recycle, how you control noxious weeds, what are the ticks, the bears, the cougars, what do you think about in terms of fire? And this was based on the Metau Conservancy, which is another land use, land trust up in Winthrop. They have some similar products. So we're really proud that we are just providing general information to people moving in. And we hope they join us, but that's not the point of our Good Neighbor Handbook. We do a very nice quarterly newspaper. And I wanted to read just a little bit. My daughter, for part of her college essay, actually wrote about the preserve that's kind of out our door. When I first came on the board, we had just been given 35 acres of a hillside, which many people who aren't tuned in, when they first come to Wenatchee in July and they look at the hillsides, they say, oh, that's kind of brown. That's not very pretty. Yet we have this vibrant community of plants and animals called the shrub steppe, and the highest thing that grows is a sagebrush. That's our canopy species, and we have bunch grasses, and we have an array of wildflowers. So it's actually a very rich, beautiful, subtle landscape that grows on you. And that's what all of these foothills are. When you land at the Wenatchee Airport, or when you come down from Leavenworth, you're leaving the forest, entering the shrub steppe. Some people will call it desert. And that's kind of that negative connotation. And it just shows that the subtlety of beauty, of place, is something that we have to teach people, we have to introduce people to. So part of our handbook is to introduce some of that. And this, so we were this living room group. In 2000, we get an executive director, and somebody knocks on our door and says, I want to give you 35 acres. So we were kind of like, okay. So this wonderful person named Jacobson, it's been named the Jacobson Preserve, it's 35 acres, and I live about three houses away. And I'm kind of the site steward. So I am so connected to this, the beautifulness of this property. And so it's been our little learning lab. So we've had high school kids help build a trail. We've had to come up with a plan for the weeds. We've had to tell the boys doing their paint gun up there that we're not, you know, we have to make a rule that we have no shooting on our sign, but that kind of includes paint gun. You know, we have high traffic on our trails year round now. In the winter, we have people, you don't even need snowshoes, we have such traffic. We have 50 to 60 people a day at, you know, on a regular weekday. So we truly met a need. We're right in city limits. If you go into Wenatchee, there's a rock that looks like a saddle called Saddle Rock, and we're kind of on the north side. But it's our community needs close places that people can get out and enjoy. And we talked to lots of people who grew up in Wenatchee. It used to be 100% orchards, and all of the foothills, all of these low ground foothills, were open playground. This is where kids went to dink around. You'd go camping there. Well, now we have what most cities have, and especially in the West, we have this almost uncontrolled growth because we didn't have sort of the urban planning that Eastern cities had in place. We weren't designed to be high density. Land was everywhere. So we are now living with the consequence of incredible sprawl that sort of we didn't, it wasn't planned, it sort of just happened. So when you drive back through Wenatchee, take a look at the number of houses creeping up all those hillsides. One of the problems for our city and our county, the city is incorporated as a smaller unit. Most of this development is in the county. It means they're all on their own septic. So the infrastructure costs, when it comes that we're going to go onto sewer, fire trucks is a big problem. We've had a county that's been quite lax in steepness of roads. So suddenly, once you have a house built, the county's responsible is to provide fire protection for you. So we, the land trust, one of the things we're doing is helping our county and city articulate the costs of that kind of growth, because their cost to us as taxpayers, garbage, sewer, snow plowing for streets, all those things have a cost. And again, putting it in those economic terms rather than an emotional term of we don't want to have development. So we're walking this nice line of saying we want development, but we'd like to have a say in how we're planning it. So that's one of our functions.
So it is the trust operating as a trust with respect to this land?
Exactly. So we have it. Now I need to move on, because when I first came on the board, I've been on the board almost 10 years, and I am still so grateful for the expertise, because you need to have a land trust operates on legal expertise, real estate expertise, restoration and care of the land expertise, and then education. So those four pieces. Our Congress has said it's in the good of the people of the United States to have lands that are open to the public, lands that have trails, lands that provide viewscape. So Congress has given estate tax benefits and income tax benefits to people who choose to donate land to a land trust. So our Congress said, okay, this is a good thing. Most state legislatures, I believe it's all, I know it's Washington, have also said the same thing, that if you as a landowner would like to donate your land to a land trust, you get benefits, both every year in income tax, and then, again, I mentioned the estate tax. So this is all kind of a big finance sort of a way to incentivize people in the pocketbook to support community values. And then the whole real estate piece. So land trusts, the best thing a land trust likes to do is to hold what are called conservation easements. And the way that you describe that is a piece of land has a value based on a bundle of rights. And one of those rights is development. And that helps the price go up. If you remove the right to develop, the price of the land goes down. And for example, if you would like, you have some land and a house you'd like your children to inherit, if you don't take any precautions, the first $600,000? I'm not real up on my estate tax law.
You can give that much,
but anything beyond, they then have to pay taxes on. So land, you'd have to maybe subdivide the land or sell some of the land to get the money to pay the taxes. So one of the concepts is by lowering the value of the land, it makes it affordable for, if it's a private piece of land, let's say I want my children to live in my house and not develop. I've decided I want to keep this 20 acres open forever. I never want to see a neighborhood come into here. So what I do to develop the conservation easement is I work with an attorney, incredibly detailed language. you define future building envelopes. Let's say I'd like maybe each of my kids to have a house. Maybe it's 50 acres. I'd like them each to have a house. But there's some conservation value in this land. There's a creek coming through. There's some slopes. There's some vegetation along that creek. So the land trust attorney will work with the private person's attorney. The land trust attorney represents the conservation values of that land. So the land trust will say, well, we're not going to allow you to build two more homes right along the creek. You need to have a 200-foot setback. Or we'd like to have all those homes clustered with only one egress row. So it's this legal agreement, and it takes almost a year sometimes. We have one landowner in Wenatchee has 700 acres of a canyon that is surrounded by the big mansions that are going up high on the hills. So we have a 700-acre preserve that he owns, and he also happens to be with the developer that stuff, which is interesting. But so we worked with him for quite a while. There is a potential to build several other homes in the future, but they're legally defined. And then we as a land trust have the responsibility once a year to do monitoring. And we then have to have a pool of money set aside for potential legal problems. So we ask, when someone donates a conservation easement to us, we ask for some money from them to put into the stewardship fund as sort of our protection for the future. We have this grave responsibility of care of the land in perpetuity. So this is forever, which is quite, you know, sometimes that kind of takes your breath away. And what often happens is when you, the first generation who designs the conservation easement is very cooperative, but what happens in those next later generations? So that's kind of where we're going. And I have to say, you know, I'm so grateful. We have several people with real estate expertise on our board. We have an attorney who donates an incredible amount of time. It's all these skills that individually could not make a difference, but collectively we are truly kind of, we are considered now the movers and the shakers of the valley. Our phone's ringing every day, and we had a strategic plan. We're having another strategic planning session soon, but we had one a year and a half ago, and our biggest problem was, how do we prioritize? We cannot meet the need. We cannot take care of all the calls that are coming in for what we need to do. So what are our priorities? So I thought I'd share you, so this is why every land trust is different. And I thought I'd read to you some of our priorities, which just to give you an idea of how you can craft it for your own region. So here is just a little paragraph. The land trust approach is successful because it's voluntary and incentive-based. As a local non-governmental organization, we work with willing landowners to permanently protect land and water through purchase, donation, or land preservation agreements, and those are the conservation easements. Agreements are individually tailored to protect the natural values of the property by limiting development, while the landowner often receives tax benefits. And here are our four priorities. Our focus. Our first focus is river of life. Clean, abundant water and healthy habitat are vital for fish and wildlife, as well as for people and farms. Our goal is to permanently protect the natural functions and scenic beauty of our region's most important rivers, lakes, and streams. And because we were in place, in Washington, the legislature has developed something called the Salmon Fund. What is it? The Salmon Fund. Oh, it's the Salmon Recovery Fund. And this is money that's set aside, and then it's a grant process. So because we had staff, and because we knew our land, we knew the White River, which feeds into Lake Wenatchee, it is the most healthy run of sockeye salmon in the entire four-state in Canada, Columbia Basin drainage. So we knew that the White River was a target. We had that local knowledge. Then we have the Intiac Basin, which you cross. And if you have a little time, you want to just drive up the Intiac. It's a full hour to get to the end of the road. But the Intiac River is one of the best coho and several other kinds of fish, summer Chinook, that's what I'm thinking, summer Chinook salmon habitats left in the Columbia Basin system. So this includes, you know, all of Washington, Oregon. This is a pretty significant waterway. It had been subdivided. Again, we've had very lax county regulation. It had been heavily subdivided. So our first purchase, we received $2 million as this tiny little group. But we had kind of that manpower and local knowledge to do all of these purchase and sale agreements. So we bought, I believe, 19 different parcels of different size up the Intiac So we've now, and our criteria for those parcels was for the fish and wildlife. So we had many more we could have chosen. We prioritized those. And so we purchased those about 8 or 9 years ago. Since then, neighbors up there are coming to us. So we are connecting the protected land along the Eniat River. It's the sinuosity of the river. It's the debris in there. If you do development and you armor your riverbanks, those are not good for salmon. So by us buying those properties, which periodically flood, many of these are wetlands, you know, which shows the laxity of our county regulations for so many years. However, we have really put in place a perpetuity for salmon habitat in the Eniat River. We've done similar up in the White River. And if, again, if you have time sometime and you'd like to come early, go up to Lake Wenatchee. There's a nice state park. It is an incredible high elevation pristine lake, quite different than Lake Chelan. It's about this elevation. And it is fed by glacier peak melts and feeds two of the three rivers that come in, the White River, then the Pequot, and the Little Wenatchee. So the White River is a phenomenal deep, the whole valley bottom is a wetland. If you go there right now, you need your mosquito coats. It's 100% wetland, yet it was all subdivided for home development. So again, we have been working, and this is what's so wonderful, we're working collaboratively with the State Department of Fish and Wildlife. They have some parcels in there. The Forest Service has a few parcels. So again, by using mapping and partnerships with our agencies, we were able to zero in on the key properties that we could purchase with the Salmon Fund recovery money. And we are now in line again, you know, to receive that money for the next round. So we are a bit unusual that we had access to several million dollars to purchase land. And I know, you know, we have such public land issues here that are different than in the Midwest. But I wanted to give you those examples to show what a small group of people who have a shared community vision can do. And it's been so exciting to be part of that.
Have you worked with municipalities, cities, or
yes,
we've
worked
mostly
with
counties?
Well, to this point, in Chelan County itself, we're sitting in Chelan County, it's 83% public ownership. Now, you know, that makes sense. It's the glaciers, it's the mountains. It's not places you can build a house. So our commissioners are really set in this idea that we have so little place to develop, that we need to be able to develop everything that possible that's left, which is the river bottoms, which are this incredible key habitat. So the county, which started off as an adversary, but we chose to be, let's work with the county, let's educate them, let's work together. We are now working quite closely with them, and they're really seeing the assets that we're bringing. But it's been a long haul. And I have a funny story to tell. We have another piece of property. When you go into Wenatchee, here's the Wenatchee River, and as you're driving down, you look up at this whole hillside that fades up into forest. And there were two farmers that had tried and failed to do dryland wheat farming, and also before that, they even tried dryland orcharding. And it's pretty high up, and there's no permanent source of water. A terrible problem with weeds. We talked to both of these farmers have said, you know, one of the reasons they kind of quit farming was just they couldn't handle the weed issues, which now we're stuck with. But this is about 800 acres. So we have a group in town called the Wenatchee Sportsmen, and they really want to preserve habitat for mule deer. Now, they're not the kind of people who would ever consider joining the land trust. You know, this is what's been so wonderful. So the Wenatchee Sportsmen know that we have this very limited mule deer wintering ground in our area. The whole town of Wenatchee used to be mule deer wintering ground. Now it's developed. And as development creeps up the hillsides, that's really stressing the mule deer. They have nowhere to come down to find winter food. So this 800 acres is really a key piece. And the guys on the ground, the sportsmen, they knew that was really valuable. So they came to us, these two farmers, and we put together an ability to purchase that. And again, we're lucky to have this icicle fund that has a revolving fund of money to be lent. We got to borrow it to buy this property. We're going to sell it to what we call as a conservation buyer. And then we'll get that money to spend on something else. And I brought a map to show you. So I mentioned in 2000 we got this first 35-acre piece. So this is what we call the Wenatchee Foothills. And this is this little 35 acres. This is what started the whole ball rolling. We were given this 35 acres, which allowed us to dream big. This is the land that kids used to roam wild on and free, but now there are many, many houses. So places that we have several little landmarks that people go up to, but they're all crossing private property now. And, you know, they're beginning to be those conflicts. So we envisioned, what if we had a Foothills Trail system? So it just shows one little piece of property. This is all, this all belongs to the state. This belongs to the Forest Service. So the different colors represent ownership. This belongs to the PUD. We are now strategically piecing together a place we could have a trail that traverses all the way, I forget the mileage, but from one end of the town to the other. And there are many, many problems to be overcome. But part of having this mule deer wintering ground ties into the PUD. In order to get a license to run a hydro dam, you have to go to FERC. You have to apply for a federal license. And dams have removed habitat. So they have to, in turn, provide substitute habitat. And so what they did initially with their license was to buy this property to be mule deer wintering habitat. So suddenly, we now have doubled kind of the protected mule deer wintering habitat. So we're working closely with the PUD. We are a bit unusual because we are also an organization that is putting in trails. So we are actively developing recreation corridors. Now the sportsmen do not want any trails. They don't want any disturbance of any kind. So again, we're working in negotiated land to kind of work together. And this year, a large organization called Trust for Public Land, you may have heard of that, and that's a way you could contribute on a national level. Trust for Public Land, all over the country, they have offices in different regions. They identify key lands, and they have the money to buy them, but they cannot hold them. They need to find a local land trust to transfer them to. So we are working closely with Trust for Public Land, and we have three properties that they've purchased at a key time. Somebody's going to develop them. Someone's going to put a subdivision application in. And then we then receive that for no cost, but then we take on this responsibility of stewardship, closing the trails, opening the trails, weed control. So, you know, sometimes we can't sleep at night because of our responsibility. So I gave you those as little case histories. Any questions about what Land Trust does?
Is that Trust for, is that a state or federal?
It's a nonprofit national group. And it's, have you heard of the Nature Conservancy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, similar to that, the Nature Conservancy has had a focus of mine. Initially, they were buying lands where only rare and endangered, mostly plants, were found. They've changed their scope. They've now identified key ecosystems across the U.S. that are at risk. And for example, in our area, they targeted what's called the shrub steppe, this Columbia Basin. So we have a Nature Conservancy office in Wenatchee. They bought considerable amounts of land in Moses Coulee, which is south of Highway 2, north of Interstate 90. So the Nature Conservancy is another way. And what's nice is all of these, the Nature Conservancy and Trust for Public Land, you're not really a member, you just make a donation. And it's one of those things you can decide to write a once-a-year check and you know you're supporting the good of the whole. And a local land trust, you have that ability to really be on the ground solving those local problems that come up. One thing I just got to help do, I got a little $1,000 grant from the Native Plant Society, and we're putting together a little brochure of the trailheads about wildflowers and weeds, and then we're going to have an online photo gallery of 60 of the common blooming plants that are in the Foothills Trail system. So that's kind of the education outreach focus, and that's kind of where my expertise and energy goes. But I just tell you, it's so exciting to work with, I mean, I know nothing about real estate and nothing about law, and yet I'm able to be part of a group that's very savvy in that.
So when did housing become a part of the activity of Chelan?
Well, and actually, Chelan Douglas Land Trust is not involved in housing, but in Leavenworth, there was an old community, this again, it's all citizen-based. Community people came together and said, in Leavenworth, we have the need for affordable housing. They have a hospitality industry with low minimum wage jobs. People cannot afford to live in Leavenworth and work there because Seattle people coming over, it's a vacation area, high prices. So they have a very successful village, well-designed, clustered houses. I'm a member, so I made a loan to them, and then I decided to continue my loan to them. They're looking at another piece of property. So by having the land owned, people then can buy a house for much lower cost. And so it's all about home ownership that's affordable because the land is held by another entity and it will always have those legal parameters. I think there's quite a few in downtown, and he was just mentioning he's been to an organization thinking of starting one in Thurston County, is it?
Well, there's several of them up in the San Juans and the Bellingham area.
Yeah.
And we're looking at it for some time.
So that, again, that's a real social justice opportunity to be part of an affordable housing land trust in a usually.
Well, that's not your organization. That's a
no, it's a separate organization. And we as an organization have really struggled. We are an orcharding area. We have the best pear growing area in the world, all owned by small farmers who are approaching retirement age who need retirement income. And we do not have laws in place that allow a different value for farmland versus development land. So, you know, each individual landholder is faced with needing to provide for their retirement, selling their land for development. And so we are exploring and starting this farmland preservation trust issues. But there are separate farmland preservation trust organizations. And I think the Midwest is where those are maybe most active. And we're struggling because, again, we have a capacity problem. You know, we do have 7 employees now, but we're always struggling with turning people away, turning projects away.
I don't want to step up. Do you want to know how trusts work?
Yes, yeah.
Where
yes,
they came
yeah,
from?
Yeah, this would be good.
So, it's in chapter 3 of the book, in the book square.
Oh, good,
in,
good.
In England, when you die, right, it wasn't just that there was an inheritance tax. For some people, actually, the land went to the king or went to the landlord. So if you died, if your child was 14, and even though the land was going to go to your child for that temporary period between the time the child was 14 and 21, the lord would actually take over control of the land. It's called a wardship. And then at 21, when your child reached their majority, they would then what's called enter back into the property. Of course, at which point all the value could have been stripped out by the lord, perhaps. So there was something called the use. So let's say Dorothy's my mom, I'm her son, and she wants to give the land to me, but in that process, the very transfer offers the opportunity for wardship, and this is like the inheritance tax. The state has an entry point there. So what would happen is that Dorothy would actually give the land to Susan for the use of John. Okay, so this would be Dorothy deeding the land to Susan for my use. It didn't have to be Susan, it could be an entity. And this was Dorothy trusting Susan for my benefit. So the use was a way to get around the transfer at death, because Dorothy could name Susan and 12 other people who could then name successors. So they were trustees of the property. And this was something that, you know, initially the kings were really mad about, because they said, oh, the guys are just trying to get around, you know, paying their death taxes. But, of course, the guys who were trying to get around paying their death taxes were typically the dukes and the earls who held lots of land, who were also then in the same position with respect to their tenants. So in English law, the trust became a way to create an organization with an unnatural life. It was a legal fiction that was allowed in Britain, actually. You did not need the consent of the government to create a trust. It became then a right that people had. So now it's that trust law, you know, antitrust is against big corporations. Trust became a way of holding property and pooling them. So now what's happening with the trusts in America, and that's why I ask you specifically about the trust, this is the real estate law part, that you're creating a legal entity which is holding the land in trust, and because of the very nature of the agreement that transfers the land to them, this certain uses of the land are being taken out of the possibility of being transferred in the future. So if the trust goes bankrupt and this land sheets back to the state, then it would start all over again. Any of you could do this with your own land. You could say, I'm granting this to my children, and I'm extinguishing the right to build any buildings on this land. That's called a covenant. So when you buy your land, it may have covenants already on it. But the trust is a more complicated way of creating a legal entity which actually holds land for another use that has these really long origins back.
And about 8 years ago, it was in the national news, someone on the Nature Conservancy board, it appeared that maybe somebody got some personal gain from the Nature Conservancy action. So that got everybody worried, because we do not want to lose this legal definition of a trust. So we now have, there's something called the Land Trust Alliance, which is our umbrella group, and we are now in the process of becoming certified. So there are 39 policies and procedures that we have to create and follow. So we are working our way through creating procedures and policies. And it's all good, you know, it's moving us up to the next level. But, you know, we need to maintain this transparency in our actions so we can continue to have this organization. Now, we have quite a few kinds of other things that we do. We offer once a month programs for the public. We have an annual dinner. We try to be a community that celebrates together. So we have a summer picnic that was Wednesday night, and I didn't have to help like I usually do because I was up here. So we have kind of three social events a year, and we do a quarterly newsletter, which I think most land trusts probably do. We have some really quality employees, so we have a pretty high quality sort of media approach to organizations. And then we did an endowment campaign. So, you know, we realized we have this wonderful funder at the Icicle Fund, but it can't go on forever. And also, to maintain our nonprofit status, we have to show that we don't have funding only, 32%, 33% only. The most that any one person can donate to our group can only be 33%. So we are on this massive campaign to get 1,000 members by 2012. And, you know, to up our donations. And so we have an endowment now that we're hoping then will generate. This was the old hope before the stock market crash, that we can generate $50,000 a year to maintain our office. But we're muddling on. So I, if you want to go hear Butch, that'd be good. If you have any questions, you can. And the video, I can show the video if anybody wants to see it. They can explain it better than I. Because the whole legal and real estate parts are hard.
So there's one question. So it sounds like there are two things. You can either buy the property or you kind of get it, somebody else makes it.
Yes, and the standard way, we are quite unusual that we own so much property. We are not the classic model. Typically, you and you and you and you would all have big pieces of property that you have a vision for how you want those to be forever. And you would come to us, and we would, one-on-one, we would work with our attorneys to craft this legal agreement. And that where we then, you would either donate to us the conservation easement, or we would purchase it from you. So we would seek funding elsewhere to buy the conservation easement. So there's several ways to do that. The fact that we own so much property is, again, not typical of most land trusts.
Okay.
Many land trusts are formed simply around one piece of property, you know, a large donor. Does anybody have one in their neighborhood or in their, you know, and they're often very, very local. Because we are kind of in the West and we have expansive landscapes, we're covering Chelan and Douglas County. We're not very active in Douglas County. That's a goal of ours. So we have a pretty big geographic coverage compared to most.
Do you have tons of organizations write grants?
We do. We have a phenomenal staff, and we also have phenomenal volunteers. You know, people, all of you have amazing skills. We have lots of people who say, hey, could I help with your web design? It's, you know, somebody's just donating this. Moving weeds and restoring land is a very difficult new science. And so I'm on the stewardship committee, so we are dealing with weeds. But somebody just donated this gasoline-powered weed eater. You know, that. It's amazing what people can bring to the table. And now that we have 600 members, and then part of that is managing that. You know, we're trying to get a database and remember to call people. You know, all those organizational things that all organizations face. We want to involve people, but we've got to remember to call them if they've filled out a piece of paper that said they'd help with something.
Do you have a mentoring program where you help develop other little trusts and other people?
Well, we don't at this point, but we are struggling just with the need for farmland preservation trusts.
Okay.
So, you know, we've got some people that we'd maybe like that to be a separate entity, but we don't see that coming up, so we're gonna move in that direction. We are doing a visioning process with Trust for Public Land, offers communities, they call it green printing. So they come in with lots of map skills, and they do community dialogue. So we're in the process of coming up with a green print for our Foothills Trail. It's a year process. They have focus groups. And then they end up writing a report with overlays of land use with priorities. So I was part of the group that said, what are the best wildlife corridors here? If we could only, you know, we can't preserve it all, but what are the key places that you'd want to preserve for mule deer or for botanical diversity or for a particular rare plant? So those are all overlays that then the city, the county, and the city and the other nonprofits can use in grant writing processes. It's kind of a steering document. And I am a member of Trust for Public Lands. I'd encourage you to look, you know, look at that. I think they're quite effective. My family cabin in Montana, 15 years ago, my grandparents built a small cabin on a lake. It happens to be wilderness area on this side and wilderness area over here, and it's one of the best grizzly bear migration corridors in Montana. So Trust for Public Land came in right as Plum Creek, which is the old railroad, was going to take this hillside, a mile-long hillside with 800-year-old ponderosa pines, and put condos there. So this is that classic thing where Trust for Public Land can come in with the money, negotiate the trade with the Forest Service. So now we have this connected public land for grizzly bear migration corridors. And in the National Trust for Public Land magazine, they had this really cool map. They had radio collared quite a few grizzly bears and showed their pathway right across our cabin, you know, across the lake. But,
going to ask you about Plum Creek. I remember seeing a map, and I was appalled by how much land they had.
The government gave the railroad every other section to put the railroad in across the west.
Oh.
That was the incentive. So that's why in the west we have what's called checkerboard land ownership.
Uh-huh.
So most of the agencies are trying to consolidate. And we, as a land trust, we are part of a player. We have a public lands dialogue that we initiated. So we're getting, in Wenatchee, we're getting the Forest Service to come, the BLM, the state, the county, and us to kind of say, gosh, could we trade among ourselves? It's very complicated, and we're not even sure we could pull it off with the Forest Service rules. But that is a tendency for all of our agencies in the West, because how can you manage lands that do this? And so they are trying to consolidate. So go hear Butch if you want to do that. And I have, if you'd like any of these, any of our materials, I'd be happy to bring them.
Awesome.
Thank you. Oh, I didn't get to finish my story about my daughter for her college essay wrote about her connection to this little piece of land.
Oh.
Basin Current, so sweet. But she said, I grew up 50 yards away from a steep, dry sagebrush and bitterrush covered mountain, home to rattlesnakes, coyotes, deer ticks, and even a rusting 1950s washing machine. And I loved it. Scrambling or jogging up the hill was an adventure into the wild, beautiful, adult-free world. Last year, I was pretty far away at college, and when cabin fever kicked in, I told stories about my sagebrush-covered backyard. Most of my friends liked nature, but just why this nearly desert ecosystem captured my heart was hard to explain to them. Their close encounters with the outdoors were in wetter parts of the world, waterfalls, lush green parks, or national park scenery, so astounding that advertising agencies used to sell SUVs. What was so special about a relatively barren hill? It's hard to imagine how treeless brown hills can be beautiful until you've watched the grass bend and rise in a strong wind like waves in a muted inland sea, or slept in the backyard on an August night and woken to hear the haunting yelps of coyotes drifting down over a deceptively suburban scene. Even the smell of sagebrush stings the nose a bit at first. Only after years of bringing it home on my fingers and jeans did I start to enjoy the sharp tang. The harshness, really the wildness, of the Jacobson Preserve property makes its beauty elusive. You have to search for the tiny, exquisite, blue-eyed Mary flowers hidden among the bunch grass. Only after an afternoon of sweating through scratchy dry grass can you appreciate the luxury of shade and moss at a tiny snowmelt-fed ravine. The crucial element in the sagebrush beauty, which I just couldn't express to my faraway friends, was that I had experienced it. How lucky we are to live in a place where nature can still be loved and lived in as wilderness. They will probably never film a car commercial on our hill. Still, as long as people can climb up it, play around, and get to know it personally, I'm sure it will be well loved and well protected. So it was great that.
Nice
verse.
I made a difference. My God,
you said major deficit was one.
Yes,
and
yeah.
And you had another one.
Well, it was called Major Deficit Disorder and Last Child in the Woods. So if you go to your library, you can, his name is Loevs. It's like loves, but the words are mixed up. Last Child in the Woods. And it's quite a compelling book, and several people have mentioned it to me up here. It's kind of on the tips of a lot of parents and especially organizations that do conservation. So anybody want to?
And there was something about inside too.
Yes. Let's see.
I have our homeowners group.
Yeah, this
maybe
would be
we could establish
this
something
could,
like this.
I think you maybe could go to one that's already established that, to help you.
Because we have members of our group that are active in the trail system.
Oh, yes.
And
Do you have another flower one?
My
wife is on the park board.
Here's the trails one. Yeah.
Okay, excellent.
So here's the...
And you guys have a website?
We do, yes.
Okay, excellent. I'll just, then I may just give you a call sometime.
You know, do that because the LTA, the Land Trust Alliance, could get you hooked up to the local one.
Excellent.
And you know, it is, you could start your own from scratch, but just the nonprofit application.
Yeah, and maybe we just hook up with somebody.
You want to hook up with an existing organization.
Yeah, tell them our story. We do have, we call it the Main Creek coming down through. And it does have cutthroat trout. But I'm thinking, hey, what an opportunity. We could, because that land is close to this land parcel that we want, that the school district owns. They're thinking of selling it, see, and they can't sell it now.
You could be a little muscle, to get them.
Yeah, excellent idea.
Yeah. And you know, maybe you'll have an attorney in your organization.
Oh, we do. He's two doors down, and he's volunteered to help us, and I just stick him on.
Because it's amazing, the legalness of this is just blows you away. And then also the real estate, so you can get somebody, those three pieces.
Because we're fighting the city council, and we're also fighting the real estate developers that in our town. I know that.
So right now, you own the land as homeowners?
The land where we're at, but right behind us is called the Green Belt, and it's actually not, the city
it's
hasn't,
called
it's called a Green
it's
Belt.
It's not funded.
It's not funded, because the Renton School District owns it.
Okay.
It was supposed to be reserved as a middle school, but it's not fit to make a middle school because it's too narrow.
Hey, you have an amazing land trust. You have such savvy land trust over if you're in Renton, Washington.
Oh, okay.
Is it called the Cascade Land Trust?
Oh, is that
it? Heard the executive director of that. He just blows you away with what he's done in Renton, Issaquah, the whole area.
Cascade Land Trust.
I believe it's called, but just Google, Seattle Land Trust.
Okay,
I'm not sure the exact name, but they're in place, I think, to help.
Because we're thinking strategy. What can we do? Should we go write grants? Should we try to get some state money?
It's
in our the comprehensive plan of our city. Of course, our city's only been in existence for about 8 years now.
What's the name of it?
Newcastle.
I've heard of that, and
that's
why
in
I've
between
never
Renton
where it is.
And Bellevue.
Yeah.
It used to be an old coal mining town. A little bit up in the foothills, but it was abandoned in the 30s, and they took the name away.
Interesting.
And so now we had resurrected that name. It was funny because they had a contest to choose what name we wanted.
Oh, wow.
It was Newport Shores, Newport Hills, or Coal Creek, or and somebody came up with Newcastle. One of the names on the was not Renton.